do say about you and me? Are we not to be a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people belonging to God? Are we not to be the people that, a new command I give you, love one another? Why? So we can have warm fuzzies and sing kumbaya? No. So we can get koinonitis? No. So that all will know that you are my disciples. So even in the New Testament, that theme of being at the center, if you will, that the world is to be looking at the nation of Israel back then and going, there is something different about this nation. You talk about a blessed people. Oh, my word. I would submit to you, I think some of that same theme is supposed to carry through to us today. That the world is to look at the church and say, wow. I don't know what it is. Can't put my finger on it, but there's something different there. And so then it begs the next obvious question. Do they see it? We won't answer that one. I think at times they do. And not so much at other times. Okay. Same with Israel's history. Up and down. But never forget the goal. Other questions? Comments? Why does that not surprise me?
There's a whole part of the world that is totally left out.
Which part? That's true. But we do not know when they were populated either. But much of Europe was there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. In South America, for sure. In North America, yeah. Yeah. I'm not even going to go there. And I think part of that's true, Steve. And I would submit to you that if you knew that that nation over there was blessed, where would you go to find out why? You'd go there. What's that?
They probably had no contact.
Possibly, but it took a lot longer for word to travel. But obviously, the Queen of Sheba found out about Solomon. Well, I know it's Northern Africa, but nonetheless. I don't know. They are without excuse. And so, yes, God put his people on display, but ultimately, according to Romans 1, God himself was on display for all the world to see. So there's your curveball. And that's part of the, when we talked about Leviticus, that God told Moses to tell the people, here's what the priests are to do, here's what they are to do, here's what the Levites are to do, so everybody knew. So this was a community sense of understanding, so that they, if you're the priest and you're trying to hide something from me, I go, excuse me, I know what the law says, you can't do that. So there was kind of this mutual accountability built into the law, but as soon as you remove that, yeah, then you create the secret society, so to speak, of the priest. And you see that evident even in the New Testament. What did the Pharisees say about the people? Well, they're just a bunch of dumb clucks. They don't know the law. We know the law. I mean, they didn't quite use those words, but you get the point. You know, but that comes through loud and clear.
That,
that's a perpetual challenge. Yeah. Any other questions or comments, observations? Most would, I believe most scholars would say it was finalized in the form it was now by the year, give or take, 400. It was after the exile, and it had to be sometime in there because the Septuagint was written about 300 BC, and that was a translation of the Hebrew Bible, so it was already intact at that point. So most believe it was after the exile that the people finally turned the corner, if you will, and became monotheistic. They became people of the book. And that's when the synagogues started sometime, well, probably a little later than that, but because the second temple took a long time to get built, even, you know, wasn't finished till Herod, but... So that the but it was after the exile that the people, there's a sense of, okay, now we finally get it. And then it seems they went the other way and became so much people of the book that they lost the God of the book. Yes, it does. And many scholars would tell you that if Moses wrote parts of the Pentateuch, that was 1400-1500 BC, depending on who you read. And if it was finally compiled and edited and everything was put into place, give or take 350 to 450, somewhere in there, yeah, you're talking 1,000 years or more. Nobody. Basically, there was a scroll, but it was passed on orally. Right? And that was, I think that's a good question. That was part of the editing process of compiling of what the prophets referred to in the book of the law. They had the tradition of the oral law versus the written law. The written law was what, here's the scroll of Leviticus. We know what it says. And even that those scrolls seem to have gone through some editing. But there was this whole tradition of the oral law. And it wasn't, that actually the Talmud, the Jewish Talmud, that didn't take place until about 200 A.D. And they call it the Babylonian Talmud and the Jerusalem or the Palestinian Talmud. There's two kind of versions of it. But that's actually the rabbis taking the oral law, that which passed from generation to generation. You got to remember this, son. Daughter, here's what God said. Oh, yeah, okay. And they would get it. You know, I mean, we see some of that because we go, yeah, right, how did they ever pass along something for 1,000 years? Well, have you ever gotten together with your brothers or your sisters or family members and you're recounting a story? And you say, well, remember we got up that morning and we did this, and your brother says, that's not how it happened. Don't you remember we did this? Oh, yeah, that's right. So within the community, they could sort of balance each other. They could, oh, yeah, that's right. That's how it happened. Now, that does not mean things didn't get shaped and formed even within the life of the community. But it was a very different culture, and it was an oral culture. So they lived by what the priest, because if you read Ezra, would get up, he and some other, and they would teach the people from the book of the law. So they would, it was a community event to be taught. It wasn't anything like we have today. It was very community oriented, and they would give their interpretations of that. And we see that even, you'll see that one of the Jewish levels of interpretation, there's four levels, but one of them is a Parashah, or Derashah, I mean, and they shorten it up called Drash. And a Drash is what, when you'll see this in Acts, that they would invite Paul to come into the synagogue. Hey, you're visiting, you got something to share with us. And he would, you know, they'd read from the book of the law. Okay, give us your wisdom, or what did you hear? And Jesus gave in Luke 4 one of the shortest drashes on history. Rabbi, come. The Spirit of the Lord, he's reading from the scroll of Isaiah. And the Spirit of the Lord is upon me. And he has sent me to preach the good news. And he sits down. And everybody's looking at him, because they know what's going to happen. He's supposed to now comment on what he just read. And he does. But all he says is, today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing. That's it? Mm-hmm. Is he saying what I think he's saying? And so that was, it was that oral tradition, the passing down, the community was shaped by the passing down of the text. And you'll see when they forgot the text in the reforms of King Josiah, they found the book of the law. He reads, the scribe Shaphan reads the book of the law. Jeremiah goes, oh my word. Because obviously it had not been read. It had not been brought to their remembrance. And whenever, they're no different than we are. Guess what? I guarantee, let's do a test. For the next 20 years, none of you read your Bible. I'll guarantee in 20 years you all won't be as nice as you are now. Because you will have forgotten. In the making of the Old Testament, you mean? But again, please hear me. That is, they had a very communal understanding that God was shaping and working in and through the life of the community. We read it and go, God said, excuse me, what did you say? Okay, was that word first or second? Okay, how do I spell that word? That had nothing to do with their understanding. They saw God through the events, through the happenings, the rise and the fall of kings, the priest Ezra. God was at work. In and through the life of the community, God was inspiring and bringing his word to where he wanted it. We just kind of struggle with that concept, where for them that was, what's the problem? Well, Deuteronomy, we talked about Deuteronomy specifically, but you could read all of the Old Testament and there are cantillation marks on all of the Old Testament. Hebrew is meant to be sung. Probably. Yeah. And, you know, we had a rabbi friend up in Canada. And he would do the Aaronic blessing, but when he would do it, he would sing it. He never taught me to sing it, so I don't know how to sing it.
Was there singing different?
How would you say it? It's a different, it's Jewish, I don't know. It's more of a chant, yeah. I was going to do it last week, but our musicians didn't know the words or the music. Have any of you ever heard the song, He Named My Tov? Does that mean no? Well, it does. And if you have ever seen the movie, what's the movie where in Tebby, where the, what's that? Fiddler on the Roof, where they rescue the hostages from the airport in Munich or wherever. Yeah. And there's a movie about that, about these Israeli commandos. They're on the plane, headed there, and in the back of the plane, all these commandos, all of a sudden, they'd start singing, Hinei matovu manahim, shevet akim gam yakan. Hinei matovu manahim, shevet akim gam yakan. Hinei matov, hinei matov. And it comes out of Psalm 133. How blessed and good it is for brothers to dwell together in unity. And it's a great song because it just goes faster and faster and faster and faster. And it's very Jewish.
Beautiful.
It seems to me like they're celebrating more, and I'm not sure. It seems like they're celebrating more community and unity among themselves than praise of the hymns.
There's truth to that, yes. Yeah, there's truth to that.
And there's nothing wrong with that, but I
right.
think that's just how I'm interpreting it.
Yeah.
And it's like a party.
Yeah, the Jewish people know how to party. I wonder where they learned that from. You suppose it was the God that gave them seven feasts? And the Feast of Sukkot, okay, I want you to party for 7 days straight. All right. But that's a part of, I think you recognize that simply because that is a very real part of their ethos, is we're in community together. And so when they celebrate, you know, you go to an Orthodox home and celebrate Passover, we're celebrating when God brought us out of Egypt. You're going, He brought you out of Egypt. Well, that was 3,500. What are you talking about? No, He brought us out of Egypt. Because there's a very, they understand, that's their mindset. And we don't think in those terms. So, it has its very real challenges. And I think that one of the biggest challenges is we really don't understand community. You know, last year Corey was in the world race? My niece Corey was in the world race, and she spent 11 months together with a group in 11 different countries. And she said, you know what? I learned about community. Because it was the good, the bad, and the ugly. We had to spend 24/7 for 11 months with people that we didn't really know. And we had to work stuff out. We don't. You know what we do? We have keys. Put it in reverse and drive. I'm out of here.
Well, but when we were settling, we had
that's true. That is very true. We were more community-minded 200 years ago than we were. By far. And ask yourself, was that a good thing? And I say, yeah, it was.
Well, it also
sure. And in most small towns in America, what was the community center? The church. And we recognize even some of that today. We call them neighborhood watches. So there's even a remnant of that. We understand that, you know what, if you look out for my house and I look out for yours, we're better off than not doing anything. So there's, you still see, I think, hints and clues of that in our culture, but for the most part, we live individual lives in the West, I think to our downgrade. But any other questions? Biblical.
Verses 8 and 9, chapter, they kind of, Joshua's mark.
Yes.
Book of the law.
Yeah, chapter 1 as a whole, but yes.
And also,
that what?
That I will be with you.
Yes. And Joshua, it seems, if you read the book, rest of the book of Joshua and ask yourself, did Joshua take those verses to heart and live them out, you'd go, yeah, I think so. But what's interesting is, in just before those verses, God says to Joshua, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now, therefore, go. In other words, Josh, that chapter is done. And what do we generally tend to do? Oh, man, I want to go back to that chapter. I like that chapter. There was some good stuff in that chapter. Do we really have to leave that chapter, God? Moses, my servant, is dead. Now, therefore, go. And so it's a real critical turning point, I think, not only in the nation, but especially in Joshua's life. Because imagine you're with Joshua. You have spent 40 years with Moses, side by side. You have been in the tent of meeting. You have seen the glory of God, the pillar of fire. You have experienced that. And now he's gone. You're it. That was a huge turning point for Josh. Oh, sure. Oh, absolutely. You think? When God says, speak to the rock, y'all speak to the rock. None of this beating the rock. But no. Caleb. Moses, Aaron, his sons, Joshua and Caleb. And obviously there were, again, back to the issue of numbers, but there were thousands of people that came out of Egypt that entered the Promised Land. Just none of the men over 20 years old in the of military age. That generation, if you were 20 years old and older, that generation of men died in the wilderness. But their wives, their sons, their daughters, they lived through that wilderness experience and went into the Promised Land. So, not necessarily, no, because you could be, I think fighting age was like 20 to either 40 or 50. So you could have been 50 years old and go and lived to be 70 or 80 and died. You just would not have entered the Promised Land. So, and I think we see that the blessing of God even on Caleb, because when he enters the Promised Land, he says, I'm now 80 years old and I'm just as strong now as I was then. Don't you wish you could say that, Jack? I'm just as strong now as I was when I was 40. But so you got to keep those things in mind when you say that all that generation perished. Well, yes, but exactly who are we talking about? We're talking about just the men of military age over 20 years old. So, okay. I believe in the book of Numbers, it talks about giving a census of those of the military or fighting age able to go to war 20 years and older. So that seemed to be the cutoff. Yeah. But that seems to have carried through. Does anybody know who is the oldest disciple? Most likely. Which one? Well, he lived, not the one that lived the longest. Who was the oldest? At the time when Jesus had his 12 disciples, who was most likely the oldest disciple? Why? He was married. But we know he was most likely over 20 years old because the scribes and Pharisees came up to Peter and said, does your rabbi not pay the temple tax? And Jesus then, so Peter, if a king issues a tax, who's exempt, the sons or strangers? Well, obviously the sons, So to not cause offense, go throw a hook in, and the first fish you catch, will have a shekel in its mouth. Give it to him for both you and me. Why not the other disciples? They weren't old enough to be taxed yet. So they were most likely, all of the other disciples were actually teenagers. So keep that in mind. Most likely the disciples were all teenagers. What's that? You'll look at them differently next time you pass them on the street. That's true. Doesn't necessarily mean you're older just because you're a tax collector. Sure, he could collect the taxes, but that doesn't mean you're over 20, by definition. Because you could be you would take up your father's trade. And so most likely, I mean, historically, we don't know, but that Matthew probably came from a group, a family that had been tax collectors, or that had worked with the Romans, that's what Dad did, so we don't really know because the text is silent on that. But anyway, just a closing note. Next week,